I'm Tanya Mosley, and I want to thank you for listening to the Here and Now podcast. I also want to ask you to do something. Support your NPR station with a donation right now at donate.npr.org/now. Your contribution supports the reporting you hear every day, the latest from Washington, where a new administration is preparing to take over, and reporting from across the country on the surge of COVID-19 cases. Your donation ensures that you're hearing a range of voices, the experts, and also the everyday people who are experiencing all of this right now, like we all are. You're also helping to make possible those unforgettable interviews with authors, big thinkers, and creatives in the fine arts and popular culture. Those moments that make you want to listen every day. So make a donation to your NPR station now. Your contribution is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Merry Christmas. We hope you're finding some socially distanced joy today. We're keeping an eye on the relief bill that hasn't been signed by President Trump and a car explosion in Nashville, adding to this rough year. Yes, a global pandemic, but so many other stories. President Trump impeached but not convicted, terrible wildfires, the shooting deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. In the next week, we'll have several end-of-year conversations. Today, one with one of our favorite guests, Lise Doucette, the BBC's chief international correspondent. Lise, you've covered conflicts all over the world. How would you put this year in perspective?
I've never, ever covered a story where there is one threat, one danger, one crisis affecting our one world. This is not just a question of Yemenis a step away from famine, or Afghanistan on the brink of another war, or some country in Africa battling a pandemic in its region. This was a global pandemic, and that's quite an extraordinary thing. This was a virus which underlined that borders in our time really cannot contain the threats of our time, whether they're this virus or the threat of extremist groups, or, of course, migration, which tests both our political systems as well as our humanity. And it was also a time where we all understood palpably that health is a public good, and that scientists, the scientists of our time, are really the heroes of our time to keep all of us safe.
Well, not everyone wanted to listen to the scientists, and not just here in the U.S. But I'm also wondering if this pandemic revealed a problem with the global infrastructure built to respond to things like this. President Trump slammed the WHO, but others were also critical of that international agency. Early on, they were accused of having maybe an unwillingness to pressure China a little more. On the other hand, people thought in China coming up with the DNA of this virus so quickly and sharing it was noble. What's your sense of how the world responded?
You're absolutely right, Robin, that even a global crisis like this has also underlined that we are divided, which is why since the beginning of this pandemic, when it was absolutely clear it was a global pandemic, there was a mantra recited time and again by the world's humanitarian leaders that no one is safe until we are all safe. And I have to say that I saw this firsthand when I started the year. I spent 3 weeks in Yemen, where even before the pandemic, the health system was on the brink of collapse. And in the middle of the year, I went to Afghanistan, another country where the health system is absolutely perilous position. And we saw during these months where everyone, when there was so much fear of the virus, that when countries like Afghanistan and Yemen, the most vulnerable of the countries, tried to get PPE on the world market, all of it had been bought up by the wealthier nations. The head of the WHO in Afghanistan told me he had sleepless nights because there were days where they simply did not have a single drop of reagents, which is a critical compound used in testing for COVID-19. They finally got it, but it was a real scramble. But it is, again, back to that mantra, no one is safe until everyone is safe. And yes, the institutions are not perfect. They have made mistakes. But unless we all pull in the same direction, these institutions will be weaker still. Mm.
A couple other headlines from the past year. Iran shot down a Ukrainian jet by mistake, it turned out, but 176 people killed. Afghanistan, a place you know so well. President Trump is pulling thousands of American troops out, even though there's Taliban violence that hasn't ended, attacks claimed by ISIS and the Taliban fighting each other. Your thoughts on Afghanistan emerging whole from this year?
There is a joke we have in Afghanistan, but it's an example of the black humor that Afghans are quite famous for, is that with every year, almost every year since the attacks of September 11 in 2001 toppled the Taliban, Afghans and their allies have said, this is a critical year. And the next year, this is a critical year. Well, next year is the critical year of all critical years, in the sense, as you said, this is according to the unprecedented deal signed between the United States and the Taliban in February of this year that all US-led NATO forces, the remainder of them, are to leave by May the 1st. But when I was in Afghanistan, I spent 6 weeks in Afghanistan a few months ago, and General Miller, who's the top US commander in Afghanistan, said that withdrawal is contingent on both sides keeping their commitment under that February deal. And the Taliban commitments include providing security guarantees that they will not allow Afghanistan to become a safe haven again. And the UN and, you know, members of Congress still say that the Taliban have not kept their word on that. I think it's quite clear now. This is next year, 2021, is going to be the year that either on the battlefield or through the negotiations, the Taliban are going to return to power. And of course, Afghans and their allies, including the United States, are hoping against hope that that process of a new political order will be achieved through the negotiations, which began in September, and not through another descent into the kind of chaos and violence that Afghanistan has seen time and again.
You mentioned the Trump administration striking that deal with the Taliban. The Trump administration also struck historic deals between Arab countries, some Arab countries, and Israel. But the president also pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord, the Iran nuclear deal. Your sense, I mean, people understand that things will probably change when Biden becomes president, and some of these deals that were broken will be maybe reconsidered. What, from your vantage point, what are you hearing from world leaders? What is the expectation that will of what will happen?
There is an expectation that now there will be a president in the White House with a team which believes in the transatlantic relationship. So there's already been a sigh of relief at NATO headquarters, at the European Commission. But I think there is also a recognition that the United States has changed and the world has changed. And that, yes, America may be back speaking the same language, but that other countries will have to play their part. Because it was interesting, whenever in the countries I visited in the last month, including Afghanistan, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, all of the leaders there said, we know that President-elect Biden's main priority is going to be the United States of America. And then he will look at the rest of the world.
A couple other headlines again from this past year. The Tokyo Olympics postponed because of the pandemic. A gunman in Nova Scotia just in April killed 22 people. Oil prices hit record lows because of the coronavirus lockdowns and restrictions. And of course, the global economy has just been torched by this. Your sense, what are some stories that maybe are not, I mean, there's just been so many, maybe are not getting the attention that they should?
a lot of other stories were squeezed out this year. What was happening, as we've heard time and again from David Beasley, who's the executive director of the World Food Programme, and now the organization that won the Nobel Peace Prize this year, that it was a hunger pandemic that would end up killing more people than the deadly coronavirus. Because, you know, back to my original point that this is a virus which has crossed borders and affected so many of us around the world, no matter where we live or how we live, but it has affected people in different ways. And in many of the countries I visited, it was seen as certainly as the lesser threat. You couldn't have a full lockdown in a place like Afghanistan because there's so many people live from hand to mouth. If they don't work, their family does not eat. And it simply comes down to that terrifying arithmetic.
Well, you mentioned, you know, hunger. And here in the United States, more people are on food lines than ever in recent memory. And it's a reminder that on this day, I mean, whether or not you believe the sacred aspect of the story, it's a story of people who had nothing to eat and no place to stay. And we are still there at the end of 2020. Lisa Doucette, the BBC's chief international correspondent, thank you so much. And you know, in that way that we, you know, find it, a Merry Christmas to you.
Yes, and Robin, you know, I'll end with a letter that I received this year after I had done a broadcast where I spoke about Yemen and Afghanistan. And a man wrote me a card and he said, you know, I work in a supermarket pushing trolleys, and I'm not sure whether I'll be able to keep my job because of the lockdown. But I heard you talk about Yemen and Afghanistan, and I thought, even though my situation is really bad, there are people in other countries which are facing something even worse. So he put a £10 note into a plastic pouch and said, when you go back to visit some of these much, much worse off countries, please give this money to someone who needs it more than I do. And I think we should all try to end this year thinking of kindness when this cruel virus still continues to make its way through all of our lives.
Socially distanced kindness. Lisa Doucette, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. Happy Christmas and Happy New Year.
Same to you. A great story.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. For more than a century, a resilient city and region have relied on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve our most serious problems. The Foundation's work has been strengthened by hundreds of people who've left legacies to support our community. Leaving a charitable legacy at the Boston Foundation is a great way to have an impact now and in the future. Learn more at tbf.org/partner.
Research shows that at this time of year, people of all faiths or no faith gravitate to Christmas music. And every year, we visit with Mr. Christmas, my former choral director at John F. Kennedy High School in Plainview, Long Island, New York, Ron Cohen, who is Jewish and just about the biggest fan of Christmas music we know. And so to hear some of his selections, here he is again. Mr. Cohen, Mr. Christmas, this year, the weary world is indeed rejoicing. Because there may be some hope. You say this music is particularly important right now.
Robin, it couldn't be more important because it offers, as you said, a thrill of hope. A weary world rejoices.
Hope is what we're going for in this segment, songs that bring us that. And we listen to Pavarotti singing what we know as O Holy Night. Tell us the origin of this song.
It was written in 1847 by a guy named Adolf Adam, set to a poem by Placide Capot called Minuit Chrétien, which merely means Midnight Christmas. Most of the great music that's vocal is sung in the original language because the composer hears in his head his own language. So if you took, for example, the O Magnum Mysterium, which means divine mystery by Victoria from the Renaissance, and you sang it, Omanium Mysterium. It works beautifully. But if you do it in English, oh, divine mystery, doesn't work as well. However, Cantique du Noël works quite well in the English translation. And then I picked Luciano Pavarotti because there's so many versions, because he was the people's tenor.
Yeah. And so Cantique du Noël, which we know as O Holy Night, let's listen to Pavarotti singing in French. Oh, it's just beautiful. I want to go to your next one. Oh, Come Emmanuel. Now, this is a processional. This is what we used to sing with the Kennedy Choir, walking into the auditorium. Many schools still do.
O Come Emmanuel is originally written in Latin, Robin. It was called Veni, Veni, Emmanuel. But it really traces back to the 8th and 9th century monasteries. However, a guy named John Mason Neal in 1861 translated it.
And has a very complicated backstory. But it has that promise. You know, what are some of the lyrics, Ron?
How about, O come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel that mourns in lonely exile here. It's the call of hope, the dream of all mankind, no matter when. And then, what's the big word? Rejoice!
Rejoice!
Okay, O come, Emmanuel, deep and mystical. And then there's Mame.
Haul out the holly, put up the tree before my spirit falls again. Fill up the stocking, I may be rushing things, but deck the halls again now.
This is the original Angela Lansbury recording from the Broadway version of Mame.
So, you know, the big deal here is that she's lost all her money to the stock market crash, etc. And everybody's so down. But she's such a madcap, wonderful, delicious lady that has sees the glass half filled. So she said, you know what we need? We need a little Christmas right this very moment. And they sing this great song, which lifts everybody's spirit up.
And what I love about it is that you could see it in July and still feel good about it. All right, well, staying with contemporary, let's listen to Peter Paul and Mary's Light One Candle, a little bit of that.
Light one candle for all we believe in, that anger not tear us apart. Light one candle to bind us together, with peace as the song in our hearts. Don't let the light go out, it's lasted for so many years. Don't let the light go out, let it shine through our love and our dreams. Don't let the light go out, it's lasted for so many years. Don't let the light go out, let it shine through our love and our dreams.
So this is usually a Hanukkah song referencing the Maccabees' battle for liberation against the Greek Empire, but written by Paul Yarrow as a pacifist response to the Lebanon War. This was 1980. But, Ron, you love the notion of lighting a candle.
A candle symbolizes light in the darkness, and especially individual light. And it's telling us that we've got to, you know, it's been said it is better to light a candle than the curse of darkness, Robin. We need to be candles of light to other people.
All right, well, here's something that will inspire you further, perhaps, to do that. We've done an entire segment, Ron, on Vivaldi's Gloria, but let's listen to just the final piece in that. Cum sancto spiritu in gloria de patris, amen. With the Holy Spirit, the glory of God, the Father, amen. That's it. Those are the only words. Let's listen. Ron, I know you are. We can't be together, but I know you're conducting. What are you hearing here?
This is a triumphant fugue of unstoppable verb. The rhythm here, the hope, the fugue, put it together. You know, the Vivaldi Gloria is a very unappreciated work by some people. It's a delicious work, and it's the first thing we ever did at Kennedy.
There you go. And by the way, this is the Monteverdi Choir. They're good, too. And now just one last piece. Let there be peace on earth and let it begin with me. This is the Mormon Tabernacle Choir with the musical trio Gentry, a song written by Jill Jackson Miller and Cy Miller in 1955. Let's listen.
Let there be peace on earth and let it begin.
Here's the key word, you know, like the key word in Light One Candle was don't let the light go out. And the key word here is and let it begin with me. Robin, so many people feel disenfranchised and alone and they don't feel important. And it brings to mind, I can't help it every year, my favorite picture of all time. It's a Wonderful Life and my heroes, George Bailey and Clarence Oddbody. He's given a chance to see what life would have been if he was never born. And he realizes how many other lives he touched in a very big way. Each of us can make a big difference. People are going through so much with this pandemic, but believe me, there are so many good people out there, and there is light in the tunnel. The vaccine is around the corner, and it's coming.
That's Ron Cohen, Mr. Christmas, my former choral director at John F. Kennedy High School in Plainview, Long Island, New York, with his annual visit with Music for the Holidays, and today, Music of Hope. Mr. Cohen, thank you so much.
Love you madly. Merry Christmas to one and all, Robin.
And a big story that might have fallen off your radar this holiday week was the Justice Department lawsuit accusing Walmart of helping fuel the opioid crisis destroying so many American lives, the epidemic before the pandemic. The suit filed Tuesday alleges that Walmart chose profits over a proper procedure by understaffing pharmacies and turning a blind eye to prescriptions that appeared suspicious. Mike Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, first of all, thanks for taking some of your Christmas day to be with us.
Oh, no problem, Robin. Happy to be here.
Yeah. Well, we love you having you being here. And exactly What is the Justice Department alleging Walmart did?
So a big cause of the opioid epidemic was what are known as pill mills, which are basically just unscrupulous or even bogus medical practices that prescribed massive amounts of painkillers without really a legitimate medical reason. And Walmart acts not only as a pharmacist, but also as a wholesale distributor of prescription drugs to its own pharmacies. So in both of those roles, they're supposed to be on alert for red flags that suggest these are illegal prescriptions being written by these pill mills. So, Robin, what the government is saying is that they didn't do enough to react to these red flags and prevent these fraudulent prescriptions. And in part, as you say, they blame a corporate culture that they allege really put a lot of pressure on pharmacists to fill these prescriptions quickly, Robin.
So these are huge allegations, but there are already more than 2,000 similar lawsuits against the chain from states, municipalities. So what's the difference, and how is Walmart responding?
So Walmart is responding really aggressively. They gave a statement to my colleagues, Jeff Feely and Matt Townsend, and it was elsewhere in the press, basically alleging ethical violations in this investigation. They're saying there's factual inaccuracies and cherry-picked documents. They also are saying that this lawsuit basically invents a legal theory that unlawfully forces pharmacists to sort of come between patients and their doctors. And Robin, it's interesting. They actually beat the government to court about this and sued the government in October for some clarity over that requirement to be a go-between between the patients and doctors.
Yeah. So Walmart was planning an expansion into low-cost clinics and insurance. So how does this affect that plan?
Well, in addition to the penalties, financial penalties that really could run into billions of dollars, the government is also asking for what's known as injunctive relief to prevent Walmart from making these types of violations again. Now, what that looks like is still to be determined, but that's the type of sort of legal remedy the government is trying to received from the courts. And I think it's a reminder to Walmart and Amazon, too, which is getting into this business, that these health industries are very highly regulated. There's a big difference between, you know, selling groceries and selling insurance and prescriptions, Robin.
As there should be. Look, just briefly, will this transition to a new administration have any impact on the DOJ carrying out this lawsuit against Walmart?
Yeah, so it's certainly the type of case that could take months or maybe even years to reach a settlement. I do think it's a bipartisan issue. Biden has on his platform that he wants to hold pharmaceutical companies and distributors like this responsible for the opioid epidemic. So my guess is that he will continue to aggressively pursue it.
Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you and happy holidays. Thanks so much for spending some time here.
Oh, happy holidays to you too, Robin. Thank you.
In South Africa, scientist Tulio de Oliveira is in his lab today, continuing the genome sequencing he and his team did that discovered South Africa's variant of the coronavirus. The Pope gave his annual Christmas blessing from inside the Vatican instead of out on the balcony before thousands. Just as well, there's no one there. The streets are empty of tourists and locals. And around the world, frontline workers are also behind doors closed to the public, trying to save lives. Throughout this pandemic, we've been trying to somehow see it, the difficulty breathing, the fear in faces, the lives behind these unfathomable numbers, so we don't lose sight of them. It's hard because it's so understandably locked away. But CNN reporter Miguel Marquez has taken us inside, not once, but seven times, including this week in a stunning report from the intensive care unit at United Memorial Medical Center in Houston. He heard this chilling assessment from Dr. Joseph Varone, chief of staff at United Memorial, about the next 6 weeks.
The next 6 weeks are going to be the darkest weeks in modern American medical history.
Even though the vaccine's being rolled out.
Absolutely, because think about it. The vaccine is going to take you between 6 and 8 weeks to get immunity.
Dr. Joseph Varone, chief of staff at United Memorial Medical Center. Miguel Marquez joins us now to share more about what he found when he went inside that hospital. And a warning, some of what we're about to hear is hard to hear, but we think we have to listen. And Miguel, we've been saying this, that the pandemic maybe would have more impact if more people could see it. And of course, even loved ones in most cases can't because they can't go inside the hospitals. You were able to get inside this hospital twice. You were inside in June and now this week. What was the difference?
The big difference is that people are sicker. The hospital, about half the patients that are in there are on ventilators, which was disturbing to see, walking by rooms and seeing just person after person. They are intubated. They are out and unconscious on drugs because it's too uncomfortable to be ventilated. They stare up sort of emptily into the ceiling, and that's just really disturbing to see. The others, some of them are very sick and very scared. Others are on the mend and about ready to go home. So it's a bit of a mix, but it's disturbing.
It is disturbing. And the thing that jumped out at me, I don't think I've heard yet. I mean, yes, we have seen you and some of your colleagues at CNN and other reporters across the country have been able to get in with the permission, of course, of everyone inside. And we do see people on ventilators, but we don't see or hear this. This is a woman wild-eyed in fear, staring around the room, trying to breathe. Let's listen.
To listen to Juana Corona trying to breathe is to understand everything one needs to know about COVID-19. She's pretty certain she got it from her daughter.
That's about all I could take, Miguel. That woman was struggling to breathe.
You're making me tear up here. Look, she was hard to see because we walked into that room and you have so much gear on, you can't really hear things. And then when I was listening to it later, that sound of her trying to breathe was so shocking to me on reflection, listening to it afterwards. It's interesting. Dr. Verone knew immediately that she was having problems. And as soon as we walked out of that room, he took action to start moving her into higher care, basically, because he knew she might be in trouble. Amazingly, she turned around about 24 hours and was probably going to go home without being ventilated. But she was scared, that was really disturbing to see. And that was the one thing that jumped out to me very early on when I was doing stories in New York, is that people were basically drowning while sitting up in a hospital chair.
Well, Dr. Verone, the terrific doctor who has been working endlessly, for months, hasn't taken a moment off, showed you a vial of the fluid that's in the lungs of these people. They are drowning. And some of them are, confessional. Here's Richard Gonzalez. He thought he could tough this out. Let's listen.
I kind of messed up from those symptoms that I got when I got it. I should have went to the ER room or the hospital right away, but I didn't. I laid in bed thinking it was going to go away.
It didn't, and now he's in the ICU, so scared. You also spoke with Luis Martinez. His father, uncle, and cousin all died of COVID-19. And, so the last place he had wanted to go was a hospital. Let's listen.
Because I didn't want to do it, because you know how it is. Whenever they put you in a hospital, sometimes you never make it.
Oh, Miguel. Everybody in here, if they can speak, they're crying.
Yeah, this is the other thing that was different from when we were in United Memorial before in June, is that people are waiting longer, and that's maybe why people are getting sicker as well. They're waiting longer to go in. They're trying to tough it out. I've heard this from more than one person. Aside from being in hospitals, I've spoken to a lot of people with COVID, and they, especially like men, they don't want to go to the hospital. They want to tough it out in their room, stay. They're terrified to either go to the hospital or go to sleep. So they end up in their rooms, sleepless nights for days on end. And then some of them get better, some of them don't.
And Miguel, we should say, you go into hospitals and you were in this one absolutely head to toe protected, as was your crew. You had face shields, face masks, gloves, full body covering, booties on your feet. So you're not bringing something in and endangering the patients. And you've been in hospital 7 times during the pandemic, and thankfully you have not picked up anything. You visited with a nurse you'd met before. She was a patient. When you met her, she was in a bed with COVID-19. She's had it twice, but still she was back at work at your recent visit. Her name is Tana Ingraham. Her face is covered, of course, but we can see the tears in her eyes. Here's what she said to you.
It's like we're non-existent. And it's like you do realize that we're still here, taking care of these people, putting my life at risk, putting my kids' life at risk, my mom's life. I think we've been forgotten, truly.
Miguel, is that why you keep taking this risk yourself? Because we have to see this. We have to see these people.
Well, look, as a reporter, I covered wars. I covered Iraq, Afghanistan. This is the closest I have ever felt to that level of reporting in our own country. So I think it's just that drives me, that this is a national emergency. People are dying. Certainly the medical care and the professionals that are helping people every single day is a huge part of that. But what drives me, I guess it's just that sense that it is important. It is frustrating to be here 9 months later, having been in 7 hospitals and still have people saying, it's not true. This is no worse than the flu or a cold. And I do question, what in the hell am I doing all this stuff, given that I have to come home to a husband and to a life and that it's I put other people at risk as well. So to me, it's the most important. It's the only story. It's the only story. And it's the only way you can tell the story. I remember being the spring in New York and it was beautiful and perfect. And yet there was this pandemonium behind the doors of these hospitals. It was crazy. It ain't going away. And then sadly, it's probably going to get worse. And I'm afraid I'm going to be in more hospitals before it's over.
Well, thank you. CNN reporter Miguel Marquez. We'll link you to his reporting at hereandnow.org. Miguel, thank you.
Thank you.
So, every year we like to convey season's greetings. This year, as we just heard, not a lot of merry in some quarters. I have this Christmas card that's been up since last year. I just couldn't throw it away. It came from friends I meant to see more this year. Of course, that didn't happen. And now, since we recently lost one, it won't. And it had a poem. I stared and stared at it for clues to where we are. I think there may be a couple, and I thought I'd share it if you don't mind. It's called December by Gary Johnson. Just picture a dad or a grandpa out on what seems like a two-person caroling. A little girl is singing for the faithful to come ye, joyful and triumphant, a song she loves, and also the partridge in a pear tree and the golden rings and the turtle doves. In the dark streets, red lights and green and blue, where the faithful live, some joyful, some troubled, enduring the cold and also the flu. Taking the garbage out and keeping the sidewalk shoveled, not much triumph going on here, and yet there's much we do not understand. And my hopes and fears are met in this small singer holding my hand. Onwards we go, faithfully, into the dark. And are there angels hovering overhead? Hark. Historically, black colleges are known for their marching bands. They're often competitive, and students may be recruited and sometimes offered scholarships to join. In Nashville, Fisk University's marching band was a little-known secret in the 1970s. It didn't last long or have the same impact as bands at other HBCUs. But now, in the middle of the pandemic, Fisk is reviving the Marching Bulldogs. Damon Mitchell of member station WPLN has this story.
About a dozen musicians march in a socially distant formation with masks hanging around their necks. They're part of the Fisk University Marching Bulldog Band. Marvellous Brown is the assistant band director.
We're going to run through it one time, 100%.
Brown has been at the forefront of revamping the Marching Bulldogs after a decades-long hiatus.
Everything got to start somewhere. Although this school has been around, the band hasn't always been here. And so starting back over is going to be some work. But, I'm here for the ride.
Fisk is a small school with a relatively big name. It's set fundraising records in recent years, and enrollment is up, but money is still tight. The band is looking for donations. But that feeling of having to grind it out is a motivator for French horn trumpet player Jay Patterson. He actually doesn't mind the idea of a hard knock rebuild.
It's just something special about starting something, claim it for yourself, I just really wanted to be a part of that process of it growing from the day one.
Patterson is from Georgia. He spent the past few months learning a mix of dance routines and decades-old music hits. There are certain songs that put a big smile on Patterson's face.
Ooh, I really feel that way about a lot of them. Like, just minor parts of the show. I love I've Been Searching. I love playing it, just getting into the groove. And, of course, the butt.
The Butt is the 1988 single by Washington, D.C. funk band Experience Unlimited. The beat energizes the band and takes them to an arm-swinging, leg-jerking dance break. Bands are somewhat of an identity for black colleges. Even when schools don't have a football team, it's something that helps put them on the map. But that isn't the only reason Fisk is reviving their nearly forgotten marching bulldogs. The band says it's also about building on the legacy of the famed a cappella group Fisk Jubilee Singers, who have been recognized for preserving black spirituals. That's been challenging to do, especially when it comes to recruiting students when the world-renowned Tennessee State University Aristocrat of Bands is basically down the street.
Fisk, you know, can kind of be on the down low a little bit.
Aaron Allen plays the alto saxophone for the Bulldogs.
My dad played alto sax. My cousin, Sean, he played alto sax in Grambling's band. My mom was in the band. My granny was in the band. My nana was in the band. Music is just in my blood.
Allen says the Fisk Marching Band reminds her of the music program at her Oklahoma City High School, where she was the first freshman female drum major. The opportunity to be a part of history again is what attracted her to Fisk, instead of an HBCU with a more established band.
The fact that I can be a part of a legacy, that just holds so much more weight to me.
That's why Allen says it's been worth the stress of starting up a band during the pandemic. She's been waking up extra early, juggling classes, and fighting through mandatory quarantines.
It really was a struggle. People are scared, you know, didn't want to come on campus and catch corona. So it was a lot.
And with the semester now over, the band is taking a much-needed break. Allen says they look forward to performing at basketball games, parades, and events throughout the community when the pandemic finally settles. For Here and Now, I'm Damon Mitchell in Nashville.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.